Oregon. In weather today in Washington, D.C., it is currently 57 degrees and cloudy, and in New York City, 54 degrees and foggy. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
The time now was 1 p.m. Oh, I'm sorry. The previous program was The Gary Noel Show, heard Monday through Friday at noon. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Although the stakes were much higher in 1860, the extremely divisive election that year may offer some insight into our current situation. The North and the South were being pulled apart because of slavery, and the Republicans needed a candidate who could carry the North and win a majority of the Electoral College. They needed to win swing states, New Jersey, Illinois, Indiana, and Pennsylvania. And they chose Abraham Lincoln as the man to do it. Lincoln got 40% of the popular vote and 180 electoral college votes, which was enough to win. But by the time of his inauguration in March, seven southern states had seceded. Award-winning historian David S. Reynolds, the author of 16 books on 19th century America and a distinguished professor at the Graduate Center at CUNY, has written Abe, Abraham Lincoln in His Times, a 932-page character study of our 16th president. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Reynolds to our show now. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Now, you've called him Abe in your title, but you say he didn't especially like that nickname. What did he prefer to be called?
Well, he liked to be called just Lincoln, particularly by people that were close to him. He didn't even like Mr. President. He didn't like Abraham. He didn't like Abe. He just liked Lincoln, although his wife called him Mr. Lincoln. And but the masses, the reason I call my book Abe is that he knew he depended on the Abe image to win the election of 1860, and he won the second term as well. But he was beloved by the millions as Old Abe, Uncle Abe, Abe the Illinois rail splitter, Honest Abe. So there were these various nicknames that revolved around Abe. And so it's kind of his intersection with the masses that I'm most interested in. In this particular book.
Hadn't he earned the nickname Honest Abe at a very young age? How did that come
about? Yeah, he actually earned it when he was in his 20s. No one knows when it was first used. I think it was when he was in his mid to late 20s. And he was even called Old Abe when he was quite young, when he was in his 20s. He, you know, and people knew that he didn't even look old when he died at age 56. He still had dark hair and so forth, but still, he from a quite young age, he was just known as Old Abe, and this was a kind of an avuncular term. He had sort of paternal and avuncular, and also very approachable, like, there's Old Abe, you know, in a very approachable, kind of familiar atmosphere around him.
Haven't something like 16,000 books been written about Abraham Lincoln since he was assassinated 155 years ago, including books by Carl Sandburg, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and others? Why did you feel that it was important to add another book to that list?
Well, you know, you can read all 16,000, and I might not have.
Have you?
I certainly know about all 16,000, and I've certainly read all the. I've read the Sandburg, the Goodwin, the, you know, David Donald, and Ronald White, and Michael Burlingame, on and on and on. So so and Harold Holzer and so forth, and a lot of them are really marvelous, wonderful books. Lincoln has been very, very lucky in terms of the people who have written books about him. However, one can read many, many books and not encounter names like Harriet Beecher Stowe or Walt Whitman. Or Edgar Allan Poe.
Or Euclid, the writers
of his era and so forth. And
you mentioned Euclid as well.
And Euclid, some people do mention that he studied Euclid on his own, but Euclid and Robert Burns and even Shakespeare is usually not mentioned. He memorized Shakespeare by the page, not to impress people at parties or whatever, but just because there were certain passages in poetry and in Shakespeare that really meant something to him emotionally, and they kind of expressed his feelings. So he'd read a passage, a few times, and it would be inscribed on his hard disk, his brain. It would be inscribed there in the middle of the Civil War or something. At a particular moment, he would come out with a passage of Shakespeare or something. So, yeah, I'm very interested in his interaction with culture and culture on all levels. He was familiar with high culture, with opera, and with Shakespeare, and low culture, the frontier humors, which was quite grotesque and sometimes sort of dirty jokes and so forth. So he was, and everything kind of in between. He was, even though he had less than 1 year of schooling, primary schools basically, and sort of junior high school, but less than 1 year, he just would read a lot, and more than that, even he would observe the world around him, and he was always very curious about so many different things.
So that's why you've called this a cultural biography.
Yeah.
Now, his parents were Southern Cavalier on his mother's side and New England Puritan on his father's. I imagine that would have been made it a bit difficult to merge those two very disparate influences.
Yes, and he tried to actually submerge them in a sense, because a lot of people at that time, they were aware of the slavery divide, yes, but they were also, they built up this real myth of the Northern Puritan versus the Southern Cavalier. And a lot of people were saying this was the real basis, almost like the culture wars today or something like that. This is the real basis of the animosity between the two sections. And so Lincoln was very aware of his Cavalier background and his Puritan background, but he tried to derive what he thought were the best elements of each, the best elements from the Cavalier being a sense of honor, personal honor, and the best from the Puritan being a sense of morality and sort of social justice, that kind of thing. And but without really discussing them in public, he didn't use those words Puritan or Cavalier because he didn't want to have any kind of conflicting elements, just as he didn't really mention the word Confederacy for Confederate States of America. He would sometimes say the so-called Confederacy, but he never even wanted to admit that there was a separate nation called the Confederacy. So it was all about union and not division, and therefore he allowed his biographers in that era to call him a Quaker of Quaker ancestry. Turns out there were no Quakers, or maybe one in his entire ancestral background, a woman, Rebecca Flowers. But other than that, they were all either Congregationalists or they were Baptists or something else. But he kind of encouraged that because Quakers were actually seen as a buffer between the North and the South, as a mediating influence. Even though they opposed slavery, Southerners kind of accepted them because they were also pacifists. They didn't want to go to war or even get that angry over slavery and that militant. And the Northerners liked them because they were anti-slavery. So they were kind of accepted, and they settled in the middle states, Pennsylvania and so forth, kind of between the North and the South. And so Lincoln kind of comfortably reposed in that image, and his contemporary biographers sort of emphasized this Quaker influence.
But actually, there were some militant Quakers in upstate New York, in Dutchess County. There was a Quaker enclave that was the first in the colonies to declare slavery, to abolish slavery. And also, they boycotted any products that might have been made with slave labor.
Right.
So there's an area called Quaker Hill in Dutchess County. But anyway, was all of this complicated by the fact that his wife, Mary Todd, came from a slaveholding family in Kentucky? And didn't several of her half-brothers even serve in the Confederate Army?
Yeah. Her mother died after she had several siblings. Mary had several siblings, and then her father remarried a Southern woman. And, yeah, they did hold people in slavery. They had enslaved people in their household. They were living in Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And Mary Todd grew up in this kind of slaveholding household. However, when she moved north to Illinois, she became, in her words, even a stronger abolitionist than her future husband, Abe Lincoln. That's not quite true, but still, she really did develop anti-slavery feelings. And so did several of her siblings. However, her step-siblings, almost all of them, sympathized with the Confederacy, and she lost a few brothers, step-brothers, who died while fighting for the Confederacy. And even though she had been sort of close to them at one point, she just couldn't cry about it because she said, you know, if they had lived, they were going to try to defeat the Northern cause and they were going to try to perpetuate slavery. And if they got near my husband, they were going to kill him. So she really remained loyal to the Northern cause.
As a leader during a polarized time, didn't Lincoln choose to be a centrist, although could it be said that he kind of leaned to the left?
Yeah, and to lean left in that era meant to be very deeply opposed to slavery, the institution of slavery, and also to envisage citizenship rights for African Americans once they were liberated or emancipated. And fundamentally, that's the way Lincoln felt inwardly. So inwardly, he was quite radical, quite leftist. However, he was in a state, Illinois, that's where he rose to prominence, competing for political office in a very conservative kind of environment. And it was so conservative that in 1853, there was passed the so-called Negro Exclusion Act, which prevented free African Americans from entering the state beyond 10 days. And if they stayed beyond 10 days, then they were either thrown into jail or fined $500, which back then was a tremendous amount of money. Anyway, and so there were, and particularly in central Illinois, where Lincoln lived and ran for office, there was a lot of conservative feeling. So he had to kind of adapt a sort of centrist position, and he did adapt one. He compared himself to the famous tightrope walker of that era named Blondin. And Blondin was someone he was actually a French person, but he came over and assumed this nickname. And he crossed Niagara Falls on a tightrope many times. He did it on stilts. He did it carrying a man on his back. He did it backward. He did it balanced sometimes on a chair. or pushing a wheelbarrow. He's quite amazing. This is all without a net, of course. And anyway, Lincoln really compared himself to being on the tightrope, right in the center. And a lot of cartoonists, if you go back there, I reproduce a lot of cartoons from political cartoons showing Lincoln as Blondin, pushing a wheelbarrow. And he told people who got mad at him for not making it an explicitly anti-slavery war from the beginning, he said, look, if I were Blondin and I were crossing Niagara with my wheelbarrow contained the entire American future, the whole future of America in my wheelbarrow, would you tell me, lean farther left, lean farther right, do this, do that? No, you would let me, you know, go across and do the best I could. And it was especially tricky during the Civil War because there were five states. They were called border states, including Kentucky and Tennessee and Maryland and Missouri and others, a total of five that held people in slavery, and yet they were still tenuously devoted to the North. And he said, you know, if I do the wrong thing, we're going to lose Kentucky, and if we lose Kentucky, we're going to lose everything. We're just going to lose the war. We're going to lose everything. So he had to sort of remain Blondin. He had to remain in the center, despite his left-leaning instincts. And eventually, when the war went well for the North, finally, after 3.5 years, he did support the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery in America. And then after peace was announced at Appomattox, where Lee surrendered to Grant, he was the first president who recommended the vote for African Americans. So eventually he got there, but he knew that before then, for much of the time, he had to be Blondin.
Ironically, one of the key figures of the left, Karl Marx, called Lincoln one of the rare men who succeeded in becoming great without ceasing to be good. So yeah. He was appreciated by people who were not even Americans.
Yeah, I know. And another socialist named Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy, called him the only really great statesman in world history. You know, the greatest statesman in history. And I think both of them kind of admired the fact that he managed to navigate such dangerous political and cultural waters. If you can just imagine being president and 11 states have supposedly left America and become another nation, and then you're conducting a war that in many phases didn't go particularly well for the North. So, and yet to retain at least somewhat your composure and your control, and people like Marx and Tolstoy really, really admired that ability in him. Even though he was never himself a Marxist or a socialist, but still, they admired that.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. My guest is David S. Reynolds, whose latest book is Abraham Lincoln in His Times. What was the political climate leading up to the election of 1860?
Well, the political climate was very divided. One reason...
Is that why there were four candidates?
Yeah, there were four candidates. One was Lincoln. He was the Northern Republican candidate. Stephen Douglas was his Democratic opponent, and he tried to unify the opposition, but he failed. He ran as a Democrat, but then there were Breckinridge, John Breckinridge, ran as a Southern Democrat, the head of this. There was a whole bunch of southern states that wanted to secede from the Union, and so he led those. Douglas was slightly more moderate and yet was still pro-slavery. And then there was John Bell, who was a Union Party candidate. So you had four candidates.
Wait, they were the former Whigs, mostly?
Yeah, they were the former...
The Union Constitutional Union Party.
Mainly the former conservative Whigs.
Yeah.
Mainly the former... They were not able to sympathize with the South or with the secessionists. They basically didn't like Douglas because he was indifferent about the westward extension of slavery. And yet they considered Lincoln a little too strongly anti-slavery and maybe a little too given to civil war should the tensions become truly severe. So they kind of gathered. They were the much more moderate and conservative old Whigs, so to speak, yeah.
Before Lincoln was nominated by the Republican Party, who were the other Republicans being considered to be candidate?
Well, some of the big ones were William Henry Seward, who was very admirable anti-slavery lawyer and another, and also politician, and another, again, admirable anti-slavery lawyer and politician, Salmon Chase. And they really represented the kind of radical anti-slavery. They weren't quite abolitionists let's say William Lloyd Garrison or something, but they were political abolitionists. But they were considered too radical and maybe unelectable because of their radicalism. And on the other hand, you had
They wound up in the government anyway.
Yeah, they did, and that's part of what Doris Kearns Goodwin means when she talks about team of rivals, because both they and another candidate who was more moderate, Edward Bates, who was more moderate, actually, than Lincoln, represented different poles of the anti-democratic party. Back then, the Democratic Party was conservative, and the Republicans were the liberals back then. But when Lincoln composed his cabinet, he did compose a kind of team of rivals, which is the title of Doris's book. And a lot of these people really hadn't gotten along beforehand because of their differing views. The only thing they did agree on was the larger vision of stamping out slavery eventually, and yet preserving the Union. So they agreed on that, but a lot of their personalities clashed, and a couple of them felt superior to Lincoln himself. And when someone asked Lincoln, "Are you really going to appoint Salmon Chase as your Secretary of the Treasury?" And Lincoln said, "Yes." And he said, "Why do you ask?" And the guy said, "Because Salmon Chase is convinced that he's superior to you." And Lincoln said, "Oh, no, that he's better than you, that he's better." And Lincoln said, "Oh, well, can you find me many more people like that, please?" In other words, as opposed to someone who demands personal loyalty, he demanded someone who was competent, who was excellent at their job, and also devoted to the vision. Because Salmon Chase had been very progressive in his views of enslaved people. He had defended them and everything. So he and Lincoln knew that. And even throughout the whole presidency, Salmon Chase actually tried to supplant Lincoln because he ran for office in 1864. And Lincoln knew that he was scheming all this stuff. And ultimately he did have to fire him. But shortly after his re-election in 1864, he appointed him Justice of the Supreme Court. So he was not someone who demanded personal loyalty or who held grudges against certain people.
And he laughed off criticism. Didn't his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, once compare him to a baboon? How did Lincoln respond?
A lot of people called him an ape or a baboon, and when he heard that Edwin Stanton called him, he said, someone said, aren't you insulted by that? And Lincoln said, insulted? No, I have to look into this. He says, of coming from Stanton, that's a serious, accusation. I think I'll look into that.
He said, what troubles me most is that Stanton said it, and Stanton is usually right.
Yeah, exactly. he says Stanton is, and again.
So he obviously had a great sense of humor.
Yeah, he had a good sense of humor. Once, when he was on the law circuit, and they used to stay in these flea bag inns and so forth along the way, and infested with bed bugs and all this stuff, and served lousy dinners. And at one of them, Lincoln said to the waitress, he said, "If this is tea, will you kindly bring me some coffee? But if this is coffee, will you get me some tea, please?" You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And also he said, at one inn, he said, "In the absence of dinner, I think I'll dive into this cabbage." You know,
ooh.
It was, you know, terrible.
Can it be argued that one of his biggest mistakes was in choosing Andrew Johnson, a Democrat, to be his running mate? What was the reaction of other Republicans to that choice?
Well, back then, the vice presidential candidate was chosen by convention, at a convention. So he would have preferred somebody else, but he wasn't totally opposed to Johnson at first because Johnson had been governor of Tennessee, and he had done his best to keep that state within the Union, even though toward the end it did bleed off into the Confederacy, but he was a staunch Union person, even though he was a thoroughgoing racist. And
as we learned when he became president, that's a whole other book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, first impeachment. Hadn't John Wilkes Booth and his small band of contributors also plotted to murder Johnson and also the Secretary of State, William H. Seward? What happened?
Yeah, well, what happened was that there was a band of about five or six conspirators, and John Wilkes Booth was the head of this band. John Wilkes Booth was almost the Brad Pitt of his day. I mean, he was a very handsome ladies' man, an actor, very famous actor, kind of a heartthrob, that kind of thing. But he was a very ardent white supremacist from Maryland, and he just hated Lincoln. And particularly when Lincoln was reelected, he said, "Oh boy, you know, we really have to get rid of this guy." And then when he heard Lincoln recommend the vote for African Americans, he was in the audience, and he said, "Okay, I'm going to put him through." Now, you know, he'd been sort of plotting, but now he said, "Now I'm going to do it." And so he got his fellow conspirators together, and he said, "Okay, you at a certain time, you're going to kill Vice President Johnson, who will be staying in the Kirkwood Hotel here in Washington. And you, another conspirator, you're going to go kill Seward, Secretary of State Seward, in his home, which was not too far from the White House. And I'll be in the theater killing Lincoln." So of course, Booth succeeded. He was captured 12 days later after fleeing. But the other two, the guy that was supposed to kill Johnson, chickened out. It was too bad that he chickened out. But he got drunk in the bar, and then he went and threw his gun into the gutter and everything. He got drunk in the hotel bar and then left. The other guy broke into Seward's home pretending to be a doctor because Seward was in bed upstairs recovering from a carriage accident. And he managed the would-be assassin got upstairs and got into Seward's bedroom and actually started stabbing Seward, but he stabbed him in the neck, and Seward had this iron brace from his carriage accident. And actually the brace deflected the knife. And by that time, Frederick Seward, the son, came in and kind of managed to get the guy out of the house, and a servant helped him. But he was stabbing those people all the way down the stairs, so they got wounded, but he made it out of the house. But so only Lincoln was the one who was actually killed that evening.
And Seward later negotiated the purchase of Alaska. Following the 1860 election, the Democrats and Republicans became the only parties, pretty much a largely two-party system for most of the rest of our history.
That's right. That's right. It kind of consolidated the parties. And, it was much of it was a quite sad history, you know, as you know, because basically, even though we had the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments, which gave citizenship rights to African-American males, it would take women quite a bit longer to earn the vote. But we still had a real reaction, of course, in the South, the collapse of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow, legalized segregation and lynching and all of that. But,
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org.
Raised up in Kentucky in a cabin cold and bare, reading by the fireside, he got his learning there. Earned his keep by splitting logs, he grew so lean and strong, he could fight against the bully or could right a mighty wrong.
And we're back from the break. Before I return to my conversation with David S. Reynolds, I need to take just a minute to ask you to consider contributing to this station to help us get back on our feet after this pandemic has made our financial situation quite difficult. And that's why we're asking everyone who tunes into Leonard Lopate at Large and is financially able to come through for us right now by going online to give to WBAI.org or by calling 516-620-3602 to help keep these one-hour deep dives coming to you live on WBAI weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. And one great way to support the station without having to lay out a lot of money at any one time is to become a BAI buddy. There are listeners who contribute $10 or more each month to keep the station running and to show their support for what we do on this show. And I'm very pleased to announce that anyone who signs up today to become a BAI buddy in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large by calling 516-620-3602 or by going online to give2wbai.org will receive a free copy of David S. Reynolds' book, Abraham Lincoln in His Times, as our way of saying thanks for being among the many listeners who support the show. In fact, listeners are our only source of support because WBAI doesn't take grant money or corporate sponsorships of any kind. We don't run ads. Whatever level you feel comfortable contributing at, the important thing is that you step up right now to give us that support so we can continue to bring you these long-form interviews on topics that we hope will be of interest to you. Why not make that call now? 516-620-3602. Or go to our website, give2wbai.org, and please be sure to make that contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And from all of us at this show and for this station, thank you so much. And we return now to my guest, David S. Reynolds, whose latest book, this is your 17th?
It's my 16th, yeah.
So it's appropriate that your 16th is about our 16th president. Hey. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln in His Times. It is published by Penguin Press, and let's move on to what happens after he becomes president. Although I'm curious about Lincoln's ideas of American democracy. He particularly admired the language of the Declaration of Independence, which he called the most powerful moral law America had produced because it included the phrase, all men are created equal.
Yeah. Lincoln was primarily responsible for ushering the idea of human equality to the very center of American experience. And he did that particularly in the Gettysburg Address, where he talks about, you know, 67 years ago, on this continent was founded, you know, a nation consecrated to the ideal that all men are created equal. We would say all men and women, of course, all human beings. And
in those days, it was only men.
Yeah, in those days, it was genetic. Yeah, right. It was only men. Other people were saying, well, obviously, certain races are not equal to white races. Stephen Douglas said, "There's no way that you can, you know, call the African American, you know, the equal of a white person, and so forth." And that the founders, some of them held people in slavery, and that the Constitution was partly a pro-slavery document. But Lincoln devoted much of his career to showing that the underlying spirit of the Constitution was anti-slavery with due process and so forth, and it never mentions the word slavery, and that even the founders who held people in slavery themselves envisaged the ultimate, like Thomas Jefferson, who wrote, he owned over 600 slaves, enslaved people, in his lifetime. But he was the one who actually wrote the Declaration of Independence and all men are created equal. So Lincoln knew that this was an ideal that the founders had valued, had treasured, and had looked forward to, even though in practice, because of the customs of their era, they didn't quite fulfill them. And so he was determined to bring this idea of human equality to the fore. Public consciousness.
And he said of the Constitution, quote, "Don't interfere with anything in the Constitution. That must be maintained, for it is the only safeguard of our liberties. And not to Democrats alone do I make this appeal, but to all who love these great and true principles." He believed in an anti-slavery constitutionalism that would prohibit the spread of slavery into the new American territories.
That went
all the way back to when he was in a congressman.
Yeah, he really believed that the federal government could not interfere with slavery where it already existed, where it existed in the states. However, in the vast Western territory that were not claimed by any states, most of this territory was taken over during the Mexican War of the 1840s. In that territory, that was federal jurisdiction. And the founders had said that through the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, the founders, even the slaveholding ones, had forbade the extension of slavery there. And there have been other anti-slavery regulations, and Lincoln was very, very firm, as were his fellow Republicans, about observing the Constitution by allowing slavery to remain where it was already, but not to allow its spread. Because what was going to happen is, if it started spreading, why, you'd have so many more slave states, and they would have representation in Congress. They would completely control the government. And the pro-slavery Southerners were thinking at that time of taking over Cuba, for sure, and possibly Mexico and other parts of Latin America. So you could have had many, many, many more slave states. So Lincoln and the Republicans wanted to prevent the spread of slavery.
Now, President Trump has compared himself to Lincoln a number of times. want to play a little clip of something he said during the second presidential debate.
Nobody has done more for the black community than Donald Trump. And if you look, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln, possible exception, but the exception of Abraham Lincoln, nobody has done what I've done.
What was your reaction when you heard him say that? He has said it a number of other times as well.
Yeah, well, I almost felt like throwing up at that point. There's absolutely no way Trump is in the same universe in terms of doing things for the African American community. It's frankly a complete and utter lie. Abraham Lincoln was quite close to African Americans in Springfield. He lived in a community where there were 21 free African Americans who lived around him. He was quite close to several of them. They loved him. He loved them. He tried to help them out as much as he could. He offered one of them, his barber, who was William Florville, free legal. Sir, he was a lawyer. Free legal services. Defended him in court and on and on. And then when he was in the White House, Frederick Douglass, who was African-American leader, visited him. And at first, Douglass had been a little suspicious because Lincoln at first did not make it an anti-slavery war, as I explained earlier, because of certain, trying to keep the border states in the Union. But then when Douglass finally meets Lincoln in 1863 in the middle of the war, he's really impressed by Lincoln's progressive attitude, and his Douglass says, President Lincoln was the least prejudiced person I've ever met in person. And then when Douglass visited him the next year, Lincoln wanted to appoint him to a military position in which he would go down and inform enslaved people that the Emancipation Proclamation had been passed 6 months earlier, or had been issued 6 months earlier, and a lot of them didn't even know about it. And Douglass would have loved to have done that, but then it was canceled because the military success was so great in the fall of '64 that Douglass didn't have to do it. But and then Sojourner Truth, this aged feminist African American, visited him, and again was just stunned by his affection, his respect, more than affection, respect for her. He called her Auntie Truth. And then one of the most radical people, well beyond Black Lives Matter or anything, Martin Delaney, who was like an African nationalist, came to the White House and met him. And he, Lincoln appointed him to be the highest officer than any African American had yet been appointed to, and he was about to go off to battle, but then the war ended, actually. But when Martin Delaney learned that Lincoln had been killed, he cried like a baby for about 2 hours. He he wanted to do a Lincoln monument, and very tellingly, the monument was going to be simply an African American woman who's kneeling but trying to stand up. And Lincoln isn't even in the monument, but she's crying 4 million tears, and each tear was going to be paid for by a penny from the 4 million enslaved people that Lincoln had emancipated. You could tell many, many other stories. I mean, he really won the hearts. You know, Donald Trump has expressed a good number of racist things, I need not recount them. He's done certain things economically that have had kind of mixed effects on the African American community, but there's a good reason why the overwhelming percentage of African Americans do not support him. They support Biden because he cannot claim to be anywhere on the map with Abraham Lincoln in terms of race.
Beyond his record involving African Americans, haven't protesters questioned Lincoln's progressive record, citing his order to execute 38 members of the Sioux tribe, the largest mass execution in American history?
Yeah, but that has to be taken into context. The Sioux in Minnesota were like many, many Native Americans in that era, were defrauded. They were cheated by white settlers and by agents and everything, and they were economically disadvantaged. So they became angry, the Sioux did, and they rose up, and they killed a good number of white people, who were white settlers who were living in that area. And there was a cry for justice, and so well over 300 of them were designated to hang, to be hanged. But Lincoln, now his grandfather had been killed by a Native American, and he grew up in Kentucky, in a region that was, his family had been quite close to Daniel Boone and so forth, who was an Indian hunter and so forth. He might have initially inherited some of that feeling, but during the Black Hawk War, he had actually prevented the execution of a Native American who came into camp. And with the Sioux, he had been a lawyer, and even though he was president, he took the time to sort through the 330 cases carefully, and he decided that, okay, only verifiably can 38 be designated here. And so he actually saved the life of the lives of about 264 Native Americans, and that's always left out of the accounting of it. Again, obviously it was a tragic thing, and it was. But his agents, the agents who worked under him, he wasn't particularly good, I think, about choosing the agents for the Native Americans, and some of them were quite racist. And so when some Native American chiefs visited the White House, and he talked with them and so forth, and then they greeted him. But then two of them were slaughtered by these kind of racist agents when they returned to the West. So it was a very kind of ugly situation. But Lincoln said, you know, I really do want to reform the Native American situation someday. But, yeah, a lot of people leave out the fact that of the story of that execution.
I'm speaking on today's Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM with David S. Reynolds, whose latest book is Abraham Lincoln in His Times, published by Penguin Press. Higher law was cited by Northern radicals to justify violent acts against slavery. He rejected the concept of higher law, at least in the early cases. What was his take on John Brown and other people who had similar rebellions?
Well, John Brown, about whom I wrote a different book, John yeah. Brown Abolitionist, was a religiously inspired man who felt that God had chosen him to wipe out slavery, and so single-handedly, with 19 followers, he invaded the South and tried to create a slave rebellion that he hoped would cause the toppling of slavery, but then he was captured and hanged by Southerners, and he became a martyr in the North, and became almost sanctified compared to Jesus Christ and so forth in the North, venerated. But Lincoln said John Brown was generous, generous-hearted. We agree with him in his view of slavery, but what he did was lawless. It was against the law. And John Brown really put into action the higher law. This was, he went beyond the Constitution and beyond local laws. And Lincoln said, we just can't do it, because Lincoln knew that the higher law could be pointed in any direction. And it shows you that sometimes if you apply the higher law, like today, there have been several murderers of abortion doctors, who take the example of John Brown. They say, we're just following in the footsteps of John Brown. It shows you that sometimes the higher law can be misapplied. And in Lincoln's day, the Southerners had their own higher law. They said that slavery was a divine institution. It was practiced in the Bible. It was a wonderful thing to bring Africans from their native land and expose them to Western civilization and to give them cabins in which to live and food and so forth. So they had their own higher law. And Lincoln saw that the higher law could be dangerous because it could really be a slippery slope down which one could tumble and end up in a very bad place.
We have just a minute or two left, but I want to address something else. Hadn't corruption been a major concern during the two preceding administrations, Franklin Pierce's and James Buchanan's? Is that what led Lincoln to fight fraud and corruption with legislation like the False Claims Act, also known as the Lincoln Law?
Yeah, there have been a lot of corruption. The Buchanan administration in particular was very, very corrupt, considered one of the most corrupt administrations in history, full of bribery and graft and everything. And Lincoln was partly elected on the idea that he was fundamentally honest. He was not corrupt. And he did what he could to wipe out corruption. Of course, early on, there was a certain corruption in his administration, not due to his fault, but due to the fact that the North suddenly needed so many supplies so quickly that contractors, these private contractors, were selling goods at very, very high prices to the government. Finally, the government took over the production of uniforms and supplies and everything. So that was pretty much cleaned up under Stanton. And yeah, the False Claims Act, which is known as the whistleblower law, allowed either government officials or even private individuals who were aware of some kind of corruption to report it without being exposed themselves. So to this day, it's called the Lincoln Law. So that was one of the legacies of Lincoln's administration.
David S. Reynolds is the author or editor of 16 books, including Walt Whitman's America, Cultural Biography. He is the winner of the Bancroft Prize and the Ambassador Book Award. And his latest, his 16th, is Abraham Lincoln in His Times, published by Penguin Press. It's been such a great pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Leonard. Thank you very much for having me. And I'm hoping you're listeners will reach out and take your offer, your very kind offer.
Of your book, which we will get to in just
book,
a moment.
Yeah.
That does bring us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to segment producer Kate Guan Allison for preparing today's interview. If you're new to our show and would like to hear more, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes and anywhere else that podcasts are available. And you can also find links to our past shows on our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com. If you'd like to comment on any of our shows, or if you just want to say hello, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. Before I sign off today, I'd like to take just a few moments again to ask for your support for this station, because you know that we're going through a rough time. In fact, all public media are going through a rough time right now because of the pandemic. Support is down economically because people are going through a rough time. But if you can afford to, we hope that, and if you care about Leonard Lopate at Large and all the other great programs on WBAI, we need your help to keep it all going. And we hope that you'll step up right now and make a contribution at whatever level you're comfortable with by going online to give to WBAI.org or by calling 516-620-3602 right now to keep the unique in-depth content we bring you on this show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. And if you do sign up right now to become a BAI buddy in the name of the show, we will send you a free copy, something that Professor Reynolds just mentioned, a free copy of the book that we've been discussing, David S. Reynolds, Abraham Lincoln in His Times. So we really hope that you'll call us right now at 516-620-3602 or go to givetowbai.org and make that pledge to right now. And we hope you'll tune in tomorrow when Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Sean B. Carroll, will discuss his latest book called A Series of Fortunate Events, Chance and the Making of the Planet, Life and You. Hope to see you then.
And 340 related deaths on Sunday, numbers from Johns Hopkins University, show that the U.S. confirmed more than 481,000 new cases of COVID-19 over the past week, which is the highest one-week tally since the pandemic began. The two highest single days of new cases were Friday and Saturday, with more than 83,000 new cases added each day. The seven-day average of new daily cases in the U.S. has reached more than 68,000, topping the previous record of 67,000 in July. In a series of tweets today, President Trump repeatedly mocked media coverage of the pandemic while suggesting that media coverage of COVID is aimed at influencing the election and should be an election law violation. Really, he wrote that. At a rally on Sunday, Trump again claimed that the coronavirus pandemic is ending and that the U.S. is rounding the turn despite the spike in new cases. More than 60 million Americans have cast ballots in the presidential election with 8 days to go, a record-breaking pace that could lead to the highest voter turnout in over a century, according to data from the U.S. Elections Project. The current early vote total is more than 43% of the total ballots cast in 2016. The early vote turnout has been driven primarily by Democrats, who have cast approximately 49% of the votes so far in 19 states, reporting that data, while Republicans account for just over 28%. At Twitter post on Friday, Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, revealed she was visited by the FBI and told that her name, alongside others, was found on a list of potential targets written by an Idaho man. The FBI informed Garza that they have arrested the unnamed man on weapons charges and believe he was working with white supremacist groups. In Los Angeles, where Garza is based, incidents of hate crimes and white supremacist violence have jumped to their highest numbers in a decade, according to the Los Angeles Times. Black people are the most frequent targets of this violence, despite making up only 9% of the population in Los Angeles. Hate crimes against transgender people have also surged in the city. Federal prosecutors have arrested a self-described leader of the far-right Boogaloo movement in connection with the burning of a Minneapolis police precinct in May. U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota says 26-year-old Ivan Harrison Hunter fired 13 rounds from a semi-automatic assault rifle into the third precinct during protests against the police killing of George Floyd. The Boogaloo Boys promote violent acts aimed at sparking civil war in the United States. They've been linked to more than 24 arrests and 5 deaths this year. Pope Francis on Sunday elevated Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Wilton Gregory, to cardinal, making him the first African-American appointed to the conclave. Gregory led the Roman Catholic Church's response to an internal sex abuse scandal in the early 2000s and was one of 13 new cardinals named by Pope Francis. Pope elevated several archbishops from developing countries, including Cuba, the Congo, and Guatemala. Wilton Gregory's historical appointment comes 2 years after the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops issued a pastoral letter condemning what it called an accumulation of episodes of violence and animosity with racial and xenophobic overtones. Mostly cloudy this afternoon, currently in Washington, it's cloudy and 57. In New York, it's cloudy and 55. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington and WBAI New York.